You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Kia ora koutou katoa, and welcome to the Friday Wire for the 19th of October. Ko Stuart Somalan toku ingoa. I'm filling in for Laura today. But don't get too confused because Laura is still here, as is BFM reporter Claudia. How are you both doing today? You can't speak because I've switched off your mic. There we go.
Hello. We're going really well. How are you doing, Stuart?
I'm kind of freaking out, but you know, we'll get through this.
And also, Angus is still in the studio. Happy birthday, Angus. Bon anniversaire à toi. Bon anniversaire.
Laura, what's it like being on the other side of the desk?
I've been on this side of the desk for over a year. I'm an old veteran at this, so, you know, nothing new.
All right. Let's take a look at what's coming up. It's another big one. First up, we've got Te Rupu Nahinara National Party MP Amy Adams. We'll be talking about the week in politics. Next, we're talking mental health in men. Laura speaks with the chairwoman of the Life Matters Suicide Prevention Trust, Corinda Taylor, and reaches out to the people to hear what they have to say. Following that, Sam Smith from Radio Adelaide drops in to get us up to date with all the latest Aussie news. Then Green Party MP Golriz Gehrman talks to Claudia about the CPTPP. And finally, political commentator Bryce Edwards talks to Laura about the ethics surrounding political donations. And of course, don't forget to vote in today's poll. Get on Twitter and Instagram right now and vote. The question is, does New Zealand encourage men to harden up rather than open up about their feelings? Plus, I would absolutely love to hear from you on anything, really. Text me, tukupatui mai, on 5395, or why am I? Give us a call on 309 3879, or jump on the socials and tweet us at 95BFM News.
Hang about. It's our weekly catch-up with the National Party's Amy Adams.
Hi, Amy. Nope. Oh, God, wrong one. Sorry. Hi. This is my first time. I'm really freaking out, but it's lovely to talk with you.
No, good on you. You're doing well. First time.
Where are you in the country today?
Down in Seoul today. I was going to be travelling there, but there were some changes. So now I'm back in my own patch and about to head off to an opening of a local volunteer fire station. So it's good.
Oh, that sounds interesting.
Yeah. It's one of the nice things
of
being a local MP.
Yes, I mean, exactly is what you've got to do. All right, I thought we'd better get the nasty stuff out of the way first. So TVNZ have released a new poll this week from Colmar Brunton, which showed Nationals down a few points and below Labor. How did you react to that?
Well, to be honest, with the couple of weeks we've had and all the mud that's been thrown around and pointed in our direction, which is sort of proving itself to be baseless, I think to be sitting at 43% is something we're pretty comfortable with. I think if we hadn't had, various, as I say, mud being thrown, I think it would have been a very strong poll for us, and we're pretty confident we can get back to that.
Being obviously in an MMP system, is it worrying at all to you that now you're behind the government block as a whole quite a bit?
No, not really. As I say, this has been an extraordinary couple of weeks. I think just about the one thing every commentator agrees on is that the last couple of weeks have been absolutely extraordinary and unprecedented. We're not going to take too much about something short-term. We think we can get that back and get ourselves into a strong position.
Looking towards 2020, do you need to start looking for other friends, other parties that you can work with in a coalition?
Well, MMP, as you say, is a strange beast, and I think New Zealand is still evolving its understanding of the way it works. What we've sort of seen over that time is, to begin with, an explosion of minor parties and then playing quite a big role, and then over time what we've seen is minor parties who go into coalition with government suffering and often falling by the wayside. And one of the, I know it might sound a bit off track, but bear with me, but one of the reasons I'm concerned about the Waka jumping legislation is because it actually makes it much, much harder for new parties to get going. So we've got a situation now where both of the government's coalition partners are polling one sort of consistently just under the 5% over time, and the other just above. So, look, anything could happen to those two. And the reality is, with the way wasted vote works in the MMP system, if you can poll sort of 47%, you're pretty much guaranteed to be government. So it's a strange environment. It's not as clear-cut as people think. And we're pretty confident that we can get our vote up to a point where we're in a pretty good position.
Winston said the other day that he wouldn't rule out working with National. What do you think about that?
Well, Winston always tries to play this game of ducks and drakes, but I think the country will be a lot more savvy this time to realising that if you're voting for Winston, you're voting for a continuation of this Labour-Greens government. If that's what they want, they know how to vote. If they don't want that, they need to vote for us.
Now, the other thing to come out of this poll was, of course, the preferred Prime Minister, which showed that Simon Bridges had dropped down to 7%. Surely that's not a nice thing to see.
Oh, look, I'm sure, you know, everyone always wants their own personal numbers to be high, but the reality is, as Simon said, party vote is the one that determines who the government is. And we've got poll ratings still in the pretty respectable 40s, even after a very difficult couple of years. And that's our party vote under Simon's leadership. So he's still got the unanimous backing of our caucus because we think he's led us through a very tough time. And as I say, the party continues to do very well under him.
So you think he'll make it through to the next election?
Well, I will say the caucus is absolutely behind Simon, and we're not worried about the personal numbers. What we focus on is the party vote numbers. And yep, as you say, they dipped a couple of points, but in the light of what the last few weeks have been, once you're comfortable with that, you never like a drop. But we're quite confident that we can get back to a very strong party vote number, and that's the one that ultimately determines elections.
In that same poll, Judith Collins was on 5%. Do you think that indicates anything significant?
No, I just think it means we have quite a number of strong, effective politicians, and Judith's got very high name recognition. She's been in politics a long time. She's got a very high public profile, and she does a good job. So I think it's just a reflection that, as I say, we have a number of very strong people in our party.
All right, moving on to the inquiry that was launched this week into the National Party's culture by Simon Bridges. Do you back it?
Well, first of all, it's not an inquiry. I think the media are trying to perhaps make this into something a little more than it is. What Simon said is that as a leader of an organisation, it's on him to make sure that we do have all of the right processes and policies in place to make sure our workplace is a safe one. And I think in light of the last couple of weeks, what he said he's going to do is sit down with parliamentary services in particular and make sure that we do have the right processes and policies in place. And I think, frankly, that's the sort of thing that any organisation needs to do periodically. And Simon's just reflecting that it's timely for us to go back through and make sure that we do have the right structures in place.
I know that at least one MP before the not inquiry, whatever you want to call it, was launched.
Review.
Yeah. I know that at least one MP said it wasn't needed. What sort of side do you sit on?
Well, I don't think the events of the last couple of weeks have shown any fundamental issues with the way the party operates. But at the same time, I think it's always healthy for an organisation to have a look at itself and say, is there anything that we need to review? Do we have the right steps in place? Are there any lessons that we can take? I think if you're not prepared to at least ask those questions, then any organisation runs the risk of getting out of step. But I don't think, as I say, I don't think anything has shown up any particular issues. But at the same time, I personally think it's a very healthy thing to go back and check and see if there is anything that can be improved.
Also this week, the party president, Peter Goodfellow, defended his handling of complaints of bullying. Do you think the National Party is a safe place to be?
I've always found it to be a safe place to be. I mean, what's come out over the last few weeks obviously is very shocking, and I'm very concerned at the accounts that the women in Melanie Reid's stories revealed. I don't know and who all of them are, obviously, and I don't know the circumstances in which that occurred. But certainly from my perspective, I think the party is very, very cautious and concerned about looking after the people, not only the MPs, but actually far more importantly the staff and the volunteers and everyone who works in the structure. And in that regard, I don't think we're different to any workplace or organisation where everything is done. But of course, you will occasionally have lone individuals who don't perform in the way that we would want them to. And when we found out about this one, we dealt with them in the most severe way possible. I think that shows the zero tolerance we have for any unacceptable behaviour.
But if any of these came out in 2016, do you think it should have taken so long for anything to change?
What do you mean if any of these came out in 2016?
Well, I know there were allegations in 2016 that were handled privately, which is obviously acceptable, but I mean, do you think that we should now be looking into culture?
Well, the only one that I'm aware of that has been discussed publicly is the issue of his falling out with Katrina Bungard in Auckland. And Katrina herself says that she's very, very happy with the way it was dealt with and the way it was resolved. And certainly from that, it didn't feel that there was anything further that needed to be done. So I personally take the view of the victim. If she was happy with the way the process ran, she thought that it was done in the best way it could be to look after her interests, then I think that actually speaks to us having very good processes in place.
And moving on to the fuel tax, which I know is something that you're very passionate about. This week, Simon Bridges said the government was discussing it with the Wellington City Council, yet both of them denied that was the case. Is there something that we don't know about?
Well, we know that Justin Lester has been absolutely in and out of Phil Twyford's office. And in fact, we've had Phil Twyford just in very recent times making it very clear to councils that they should consider putting proposals forward and the like. So I think the government now has realised it's got this one wrong in the public mood and has now been forced into a bit of a back down by ruling it out to other regions. But I think the fact that the government passed legislation just a couple of months ago saying that the regional fuel tax could be available in other regions from 2021 makes it pretty clear that they had intended it to go wider. Phil Twyford was suggesting to councils to come and make proposals for it to go wider. We've had any number of councils up in the country say they're planning on making applications for it. And then, of course, we've had the Prime Minister have to, off the top of her head, seemingly come out and say, well, it's not going any wider. But to suggest that that was always the plan, I think, is laughable.
So do you think that was a win for the National Party then, having the Prime Minister say that this, it's going to be limited to Auckland?
I think it was a win for the people of New Zealand. I mean, obviously, Auckland's got it in place, but actually the indications are that it's not just Auckland that's paying for it. The petrol companies very clearly seem to be spreading that cost across the country. But for the other regions in New Zealand who might be facing an additional 11.5 cents tax over and above the extra fuel excise that the government's putting in place, I think they'll be very relieved that when petrol prices are already forcing them to drive 30% less, as we've seen, and making them choose between food and electricity, as the survey out this week showed. Food and petrol, as the survey out this week showed. I think they will certainly be relieved to know they're not going to be whacked with yet another fuel tax, but they are still facing two more excise increases. And again, we don't think that those are right at this time.
And yesterday in the House, I believe you had a little bit of a back and forth with the Finance Minister, Grant Robertson, about fuel tax.
Most days.
Yeah, well, I can imagine. Can you tell me a little bit about what was discussed this week or yesterday?
Yeah, well, look, this week we've really been focusing in the House, certainly myself with Grant, but all of our ministers, all of our front bench and Parliament ministers, really just hammering them on the fact that under this government, cost of living is going up so sharply. In fact, just today, I don't know if you've caught up with it, but Stats New Zealand has put out the cost of living numbers that show that actually it's the super annuitants and the lowest income households who are being hit the hardest by these cost of living increases. And that's largely driven by petrol being at such high levels and rents going up as the government's residential property reforms are starting to bite. Now, all of those things are within the government's control. And in our view, they just haven't thought through the consequences when they've, you know, rushed out with fine-sounding ideals about protecting tenants and building infrastructure. All of those are laudable objectives, don't get me wrong, but you've got to understand the impact on the market. And if you go too hard too fast, as we've been saying all along, it's the poorest families who get hit the hardest, and that's exactly what today's data shows.
And I think one thing that Grant Robertson questioned, I think it was to you yesterday, was how National would fund things like transport without using fuel tax, which is obviously what they're arguing it's necessary for.
Yeah, and look, that's very simple. I mean, David Clark said the same thing last week, and I got the Speaker to allow me to answer it, which is that, first of all, National would not be wasting a whole lot of money on things like a free first-year fees policy, which has seen no more students, a universal baby bonus, and a winter heating payment that goes out to millionaire superannuitants who don't need it. So what we'd be doing, first of all, is spending the money that we have from taxpayers far more effectively, so we don't need to be raising more taxes. We wouldn't be using road user charges to pay for trolley buses down Dominion Road, where there are far better ways of addressing Auckland's transport needs, congestion and travel out to the airport, and indeed that's exactly what Infrastructure New Zealand are saying as well. And we certainly wouldn't be, ramping up taxes at a time where petrol is already an incredibly high level. So it's, you know, investment in infrastructure is not the issue here. The issue here is what other money you're wasting that could have gone into these proposals and whether the money you're taking is being spent in the best way.
Now, just before we go, sticking on the theme about talking about the government, today it's been 1 year since this government was officially sworn in. How would you rate them out of 10?
Pretty low. Look, I think it's not surprising me, probably. Sorry, my alarm's going in the background there. Well, I'd rate them pretty low. What we've seen in the first year under this government is our economy slowing down at a time when it should be getting stronger and stronger, given the tailwinds that it's got. We've got cost of living pressures ramping up with, as I say, record petrol prices and rising rents and the looming electricity crisis those in the market are talking about. We've got more strikes happening in the past 12 months than we've seen in our 9 years put together. And we've got 9,000 more people on the unemployment benefit and 20,000 more people than last year seeking emergency food hardship grants. So for all of the fine rhetoric, which sounds lovely and laudable, the reality is actually they've taken a pretty well-performing country where people were getting new jobs, getting off benefits, having their incomes raised and cost of living was controlled, and really started to put a pretty big handbrake on.
Amy, thank you very much for your time. It's been really lovely to chat with you this week after my little tech issue.
And enjoy your first day at the controls.
Oh, thank you very much.
See you later.
Bye.
The National Party's Amy Adams on 95BFM.
The Wire.
That was National Party Minister Amy Adams. What are your thoughts? Text me on 5395. Coming up in just a moment, Laura has a chat with Corinda Taylor about mental health in men. Right now it's 19 minutes past 12. We're going to take a quick break. More Wire coming up after this.
Coming to the Tuning Fork January 21st, Idols. My brother is an immigrant. Bristol leftist post-punk giants Idols, bringing their hyperactive, infectious live show to NZ. Mother! January 21st at the Tuning Fork. Tickets on sale now from Ticketmaster.
Cheer up. What are you even worried about? Do you believe in climate change or something? Everything's fine. Women can vote now. Hashtag feminism.
Concerned for the state of the world today? Want to shine a torch into the darkest crannies of current affairs? Every other week on The Wire is Worry Week, taking a topic of concern and digging in deep. Next week, mental health. Worry Week on The Wire, weekdays 12 to 1 every other week with your rotating roster of hosts.
Ah, New Year's Eve, a time of reawakening and renewal. Take those dirty, bad 2018 feelings and transform them into Wonder Garden, the best New Year's Eve fest this side of the Bombays, nestled right in the heart of Auckland City, featuring the likes of Dane Funk, Jess B, Cut Off Your Hands, and Nightmares on Wax DJ set. If you want to get your New Year's Eve stuff for free, then just grab your Simplicity B card and stay tuned to 95BFM for your chance to win. Wonder Garden, December 31st at Silo Park. Head along to wondergarden.co.nz.
What are you even worried about? It's Worry Week on The Wire.
So mental health and the way in which we talk about mental illness is something we've been seeing greater media coverage around for the last few years. For Wire Worry Week, I wanted to address the stigma that some face talking about mental health and feelings. I reached out to Life Matters Suicide Prevention Trust chairperson Corinda Taylor to talk about how stigma affects those who suffer with mental illness.
So I'm thinking in particular about our men who are afraid to ask for help, who are ashamed of asking for help because of the self-stigma and the perception out there in society that people will judge them if they are going to admit that they have got mental distress or mental illness. So that stops them from reaching out for help. So stigma is a big barrier to our men asking for help. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a very good example of it. When people talk about the term stigma, it can be kind of difficult to understand what that actually means. So in terms of that example, we're talking about a self-stigma. Could you give more of a definition of what it is to be stigmatized?
Yes. So this is where this week in the media, we saw how people were talking about mental illness, the language that was used around in not just in social media by our politicians, and you know, it was referred to as somebody with mental illness that it could potentially be embarrassing. Now, it should not be embarrassing to struggle with a mental health condition, be it, you know, depression or psychosis or just distress on the day. So it's the language that people use in our society, language such as referring to somebody as you are crazy, you are demented, or you must be psychotic. So people need to be really careful how they use language that could potentially stop somebody from reaching out for help, because anybody who is in mental distress could be affected by the language, and that would prevent them from reaching out for help.
In terms of self-stigma, so in terms of people feeling like they cannot talk about their mental health and any mental illnesses that they may be experiencing, what advice do you have for someone in that situation?
That they need to be brave, and that they should not be put off by other people's perception of them. So the self-stigma is a hard one, because self-stigma could also be in the family. So you may have a loved one struggling with mental illness, and so you feel stigmatized as a family as well. And, you know, that shame, to keep that shame all to yourself is a huge load to carry alone. So my word of advice to somebody who self-stigmatizes is to talk about it, and you will be surprised how many other people feel exactly like you who may also be self-stigmatizing. And by sharing your story, you often will find other people will go, wow, that's exactly how I feel as well. Mm. 1 in 4 of us will struggle with mental distress or mental illness at one point or another in our lifetime. So chances are somebody else is going through exactly what you are going through. So do not keep this a secret. Secrets are not healthy.
In terms of people making comments about mental illness, what advice do you have for people to handle the subject of mental illness in a more sensitive way?
I think people need to put themselves in the shoes of the other person. You know, the person often making those jokes or comments aren't affected by mental illness. So in the past, we could make racist or sexist jokes. That's no longer acceptable. So I guess this kind of mental stigma is kind of one of the last taboos that we need to crack open.
When an increased stigma around men's mental health was brought up within my interview, I decided I would take to the streets to ask if men had ever felt stigmatized to talk about their feelings. I was initially met with this response.
So at the minute, my radio station is covering mental health and mental illness. And in terms of men, there seems to be an increased amount of stigma. So men not wanting to talk, is that something that you've ever faced?
Funny.
No? You don't want to talk about it?
Yeah.
Okay, fair. Thanks. I'm wondering if you've ever felt stigmatized to talk about your feelings or mental health?
Not really.
No?
No.
Okay.
And I think it's not really worth it going into a deeper discussion.
So my radio station is covering mental health and men's willingness to talk about their feelings and mental health.
Yeah, I'd probably rather not.
Rather not? Right? Yeah, that's absolutely fine.
Awesome, thank you.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. I do feel as though, like, I've got lots of friends who kind of have been through mental health, and it's been a lot more difficult to sort of reach out to them than if they were female, purely because of the sort of, like, masculinity.
Because usually some guys will be like, I don't want to.
Yeah,
don't want to.
I think they just don't want to look like they're weak or anything.
Yeah.
They just try to act up for everyone. Like I said, I think, I don't want to sound like sexist about it, but I feel like women are more like confident to express their feelings more than men. Like, I'm not too sure why. I've met a lot of people that are like girls that don't mind like sharing stuff, but it takes a while to for boys to like share something like.
While I was able to get a few people willing to speak about the subject, many men didn't want to address the question. When I was met with this pushback, I decided to take to some regulars at BFM to hear what they had to say on the issue. I mean, stigma can come from external forces, so the things people say, or it can come from internally, in which we feel like we're not performing in the way that a society expects us to. So have you ever felt that?
Yeah. Big time. Like, yeah, there's definitely a massive stigma around that I've experienced. A lot of people who think that, like, if you are too involved in your feelings and too emotional, perhaps you're, like, queer, and, like, what is wrong with that? Like, what the fuck? Like, a lot growing up, I've had people kind of, like, come at me for not being mask enough or not being, like, tough because they're, like, put together. A lot of people put you in a sin box if you've got a lot of feelings.
When I grew up, when I was little, becoming a teenager, which is when it really start identifying your feelings and then identifying whether you're supposed to talk about them or not, and there definitely wasn't a very good environment for that at all, you know. Feelings and stuff like that, but feelings are not something that New Zealanders are supposed to talk about. I remember being a kid and just watching, like, staunch was considered cool, and staunch was considered, you know, if you don't want to talk about something, you don't want to deal with something, you just staunch it out. Just, it's good to know that talking about it automatically, you know, decreases the intensity of the situation. And
Worry Week on The Wire.
All right, that was Laura speaking with a lot of people, actually. Now, though, we're going to move on to
Freedom of speech. It means you have to listen to me.
It's time to have your say. Pole position on The Wire.
Yes, it is indeed time for pole position. I'm sure you've all been waiting with anticipation for today's results. The question we're asking is, does New Zealand encourage men to harden up rather than open up about their feelings? How do we feel about that, guys?
Absolutely.
I was pretty surprised with how much of a pushback I got from people while I was trying to interview them. Like, I just showed a few examples, but there were so many people that were just like, no, I don't want to respond to this. I don't want to talk about this.
I think the results of the poll actually probably back that up. So on Twitter, we had 43 of you get back to us. 91% say yes, New Zealand does encourage men to harden up, and 9% think no, which is pretty much what your interactions with people would probably suggest.
It's pretty expected. I mean, Stuart, just from the only man on the Wire team, is it something that you feel is relevant and true to your life?
Personally, no, but I would say that that's because I was brought up by a solo mum and kind of didn't realise that there was any expectation around men until it came to school. Which is, yeah, I think probably the reason, because I've personally never encountered that, but it's something that I've seen a lot of other people experience. And just going back to our poll, Instagram was pretty much the same, 85% to 15%. So, yeah, I mean, I think people seem to agree that.
Yeah, the general consensus.
Yeah, and it's probably not just a New Zealand thing. But no, I think this idea of hardening up is very much Kiwi.
I mean, you heard the guy with the foreign accent in there also saying, no, we don't need to discuss this any further. So I think it is a broader issue than just New Zealand. But I think in terms of New Zealand, like, it is really strongly present.
We're particularly concerned with looking staunch and cool.
Mm.
We had a couple of texts, and the first was, why is a foreign woman talking about how New Zealand men feel? Now, I'm assuming, Laura, that's in response to the person that you interviewed. How do you respond to a text like that?
Automatically, I have to laugh a little bit, because you can't go around assuming people's identities just based on accents, because I have a Canadian accent sitting here on the radio, but I was
born in Taupo. I am a New Zealand citizen. You can't really go around judging whether someone has any validity to speak on New Zealand men just because of an accent.
Would you agree, Claudia?
Yeah, it's bizarre, to be honest.
Yeah.
And we also had a text in saying, what do you expect asking total strangers? But I think it's not like these people had to reveal their darker secrets. It was more just acknowledging that it's an issue. So, I mean, yeah.
Yeah, that is the thing. Like, I did come up to people and they were willing to speak about things that weren't personal, or whether the question was more about whether someone had felt that was a relevant thing in the world, which they didn't want to answer. And that's fine. That's up to them.
It's called democracy, sweetie. Look it up.
That was Pole Position on The Wire.
I thought we had a break now, but we don't, apparently. It's now time for...
You call that a news update? This is a news update. It's Neighbourhood Watch.
Hi, Sam.
Hi, Stuart. How are you?
I'm good. It's lovely to talk to you for the first time this week.
Yeah, you as well. Are you having a good day?
Yeah, it's not too bad. It's a bit overcast and it's exam time, so you know.
Oh, I see. Kind of stressful time, then.
Yeah, could be better, but you know, how's everything going in Adelaide?
Good, good. It's actually really sunny.
Oh, I'm very jealous. Let's talk about this new centre in Adelaide to help tackle Australia's food waste problem. What's that all about?
Yeah, so South Australia is kind of known for leading the way in sustainability, and this is another way that they're doing it. So they've got this Fight Food Waste Cooperative Research Centre. It's a mouthful, so we'll call it CRC. So CRC has announced that Australians spend $20 billion worth of unused food a year. So that adds up to Australians wasting 40% of their food, and that's households spending, like, well, wasting $4,000 worth of unused food annually. Yeah, and so in numbers, that's 3.1 million tons in weight, and then for commercial and industrial sector, that's another 2.2 million tons.
So is that a lot, to put it into perspective?
Yeah. So that number, that $20 billion, is just showing how much of just not only wasted money, but wasted food, which also means, this was something shocking that I found out, that food that's going into the landfill, it's rotting and it's emitting nearly six times the amount of greenhouse gases as the global aviation industry.
Oh my gosh. That doesn't sound too good.
Insane. No, it's quite crazy.
So how's this going to operate? Do we know yet?
Well, so far they're looking into ways to kind of reduce consumer culture and change behaviours on how we buy food, and also trying to ensure that people, instead of just throwing perfectly good food out, instead donating it. And I think they want people to donate to the research centre as well, so it could double as a food bank in sorts.
Right, and the chief executive, I think it was, of the CRC reckoned that the current amount of food wastage was having an impact on the country's reputation. What does that sort of mean?
Well, I guess it's showing, in terms of reputation, it's just incredibly wasteful, and it's just a shame that people who have the ability to have access to food don't really think about it. It shows that Australians are quite careless when it comes to bare necessities that so many people around the world don't have access to.
But I guess it's a global issue in many ways, Western world at least.
Yes, definitely.
Now, moving on to something a little bit more sombre, that is Prime Minister Scott Morrison's national apology to Australian survivors and victims of child sex abuse. What provoked this?
Well, this has been a long time coming. So it's been over 5 years, and former Prime Minister Julia Gillard kind of called on a Royal Commission into institutional child sex abuse, and over 5 years, there's been 60 public hearings and 8,000 private sessions where people have kind of voiced their experiences. So he's just said, you know, enough is enough. We need to listen to you. We need to apologise that we have failed you and we haven't listened to you for so long.
What do you think the most powerful moment of the speech was?
In my opinion, it was when he finished up his speech saying, I believe you, we believe you, your country believes you. And just speaking on a wider scale at the moment, within areas like the Me Too movement, recently in the US with the Kavanaugh experience, people are sometimes just not believed and not listened to, and that can, that can just be the hardest part.
And I think we've got a clip of that moment.
I believe you. We believe you. Your country believes you.
And now, as you mentioned, this was all started by Julia Gillard, the former Prime Minister. She was present there as well. Was there a positive reaction to her being there?
I believe so, yeah. People were incredibly emotional because she was the driving force behind it. People were thanking her, especially across Twitter I saw as well. Just generally, yeah, positive emotions from people who really were really touched that someone could do this for them and create the safe space to be apologised to.
Yeah, I mean, I think, like you said, it's such a relevant and important thing at the moment. Were there other MPs present, or were there other MPs that had a role in this?
Yeah, so Liberal MP Steve Irons, he actually helped write the apology. So he grew up with survivors of sexual and violent child abuse, and he wanted to ensure that people realise that this kind of abuse leaves survivors and victims with a lifetime of consequences, and healing doesn't just come from speeches. So he wanted to ensure that it was done in a tasteful, appropriate and meaningful way.
And there were some survivors present at the apology, weren't there?
Yes, there was. I don't know her name, her full name, but I know her as Katie, and she was a 96-year-old, and she was abused when she was living in the orphanage. And she's the oldest known survivor of this institutional abuse, and she actually went on to say that the apology was beautiful and sincere, and it gave her some closure. And there's a beautiful picture of her embracing Scott Morrison.
It's nice to think that people like her now, like you said, there's a bit of closure, there's a bit of hope that things like this won't be allowed to happen anymore.
Yeah, and there was another person there called Wes Hartley, and he attended the apology, and he was a victim as well. And he's a minister now for the Uniting Church. And he went on to say, whilst the apology is a landmark in Australian history, there's still the problem of cultural denial. So he went on to say it's not just the churches that turn a blind eye, but the police and institutions, because they don't want to kind of be associated or sullied in this kind of situation. And he says that the culture of denial needs to change.
And the Prime Minister acknowledged that there's a lot more to do. Do we know what is going to happen now?
Well, there's this term being floated around called a redress scheme, and that was established in response to the Commission to ensure victims and survivors of child sexual abuse have access to compensation for suffering. So not necessarily kind of stopping any of this from happening again, although that's what Morrison wants. He didn't really delve into that too much. But in terms of this redress scheme, it's 3 months in and only a handful of payments have been made, and the priority is for elderly people and ill people, and hopefully they'll continue to be compensated and they won't have to wait so long.
And finally, the Royals are about to hit New Zealand after this weekend, but Harry and Meghan have just been in Australia.
Yes, so the Duke and Duchess are on a 16-day tour across Australia, Fiji, Tonga and New Zealand for the Invictus Games, and whilst they were in Australia, they also went to Fraser Island to look at sustainable tourism. So yeah, it's quite an exciting time for people in Australia who love the Royals and love seeing them walk around and get to know Australian people.
I believe Harry had quite an important interaction with a war veteran in Sydney.
Yeah, so he actually spoke with the widow of a veteran called Gwen Shearn. So her husband took his own life earlier this year. His name was Peter Caffey, and he served in Cambodia, Afghanistan, and Iraq. And they climbed, so Gwen and Harry climbed Sydney Harbour Bridge together, and she felt that it was an important moment in her life because he was able to give her some form of closure, and also she felt listened to because he raised the conversation around covering mental health through Invictus Games.
That's really cool, and I think the Invictus Games, from what I've gathered, seem to be serving a really important purpose in terms of giving veterans a new purpose, I think, in their life, from what I've seen, anyway.
Yes, definitely.
All right, well, thank you very much, Sam. Lovely to talk with you.
You as well.
And I think you'll be back with Laura next week.
Okay, wonderful. Awesome. Well, thanks so much.
That was Neighbourhood Watch. Ripper.
You're tuned into The Wire on 95BFM. That was Sam Smith with Radio Adelaide. Remember, if you've got anything to say about literally anything at all, but preferably something we're talking about on the show, feel free to text me on 5395 or tweet us at 95BFM News. Time for a quick break now. We'll be back in a sec with Green Party MP Golries Garriman.
It's spooktacular October, the perfect time to read the hidden word and commune with the world of spirits. At Glengarry Wines, they're celebrating the Halloween season with some hauntingly low prices. Scapegrace Gin 700ml for $79.99. Lario's Gin 1 litre only $34. And Jameson's Caskmates IPA only $54.99. The spirits are speaking to you. Listen. Booze. Prices available in all Glengarry stores or online now.
Hakarongo mai, it's Māori words, because he waka eke noa, e noho Māori tau ana aho. I'm just chilling.
Hey, you look really stressed out. Are you all good?
Yeah, I'm great. Good. Awesome. E noho Māori tau ana aho. I feel fine.
E
noho Māori tau ana aho. I'm just chilling. Māori words. Karawhiua. Give it a go.
Fire up the kiln. 2 hours of hand-thrown tracks. Ambient, funk, house, new finds and disco rarities. Night Pottery with K2K. Start your weekend with an elegant glaze. Spinning late with Night Pottery. Tonight, 11 to 1. Listen on 95BFM, podcast and RSS.
The amended version of the TPPA bill, the CPTPP, passed its third reading in Parliament earlier this week, with the Green Party being the only party which continues to oppose the bill. I spoke with Golries Garriman, the Green Party's Foreign Affairs and Trade spokesperson, asking why the Green Party continues to oppose the amended bill.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's important to note as well that the majority, as it is now in Parliament, did oppose it until just, you know, the end of last year, essentially, and had done for a really long time. So essentially, this is much more than a trade agreement, and that's at the heart of our opposition to it. It's much more about sort of entrenching the privileges of really big multinational corporations. The negotiation process itself was incredibly undemocratic and not transparent, so we weren't allowed to know what the text was. We weren't allowed to know what's in it until right before it was signed, which, you know, in itself
it's
was
bizarre.
Undermining. Exactly. And then once we did know, it turned out that, you know, we're signing on to something that essentially gives these big multinationals the right to sue our government in a system that sits above our law, that, you know, Kiwi businesses wouldn't have access to internally, you know, domestically.
Yeah.
That's kind of at the core of our opposition, because we say that the government shouldn't be taking account of the profits of big multinational investors over sort of the public good when it makes law.
So on that point, you've spoken out about the effect of investor-state dispute resolution mechanisms, or ISDSs. Could you explain just for our listeners a little bit about what these mechanisms are and why they're problematic?
Yeah, so they're a dispute resolution mechanism, that's the name of them. But what they do is they sit outside of domestic law and jurisdiction and courts, but they also give this incredible privilege to sue government, essentially parliament, democratically elected representatives, if they pass law or adopt policy that affects the profits of these foreign multinational investors, even though that policy or that law might be to protect the environment or to protect the sort of greater good in healthcare or education or whatever else it might be. We don't normally do that. Parliament is supreme. It's democratically elected. It should be taking account of everyone's interests. And if a business loses profits because they're not allowed to pollute anymore, for example, they don't get to go and sue our parliament. But the system does allow for that. And one example that sits sort of very chillingly with me is that Indonesia wasn't able to ban really dangerous, damaging types of mining in its forests because just merely of the threat that foreign mining companies made to sue it using ISDS clauses just like this in a trade agreement that it had with Australia.
Yeah, so, wow. So it could have a pretty massive environmental effect, I suppose.
Exactly. And it's the threat. Right. It's that threat that's actually sitting there. You know, they may never use it, but just the fact that from now on, our parliaments and future parliaments in New Zealand even will have to think about the fact that they might have to pay out, you know, billions of dollars in damages.
Right.
Whenever they consider a policy.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's not quite what we voted for this election.
Sure, yeah. And so the original TPPA bill was massively controversial a few years ago, and the new bill has kind of had nowhere near the same amount of press coverage or controversy around it. Why do you think this is?
I think the deal itself was sort of resurrected and signed so close after the election, and I think people kind of, I guess maybe there was a greater trust. Because we had changed the government.
Sure.
The other thing is the text was still secret and we were being told that it's actually changed.
Right.
But then we, once it came out, it was, there were changes, but they're not, you know, the ISDS clauses are still there. Now, one of the changes is that some of the signing nations have also signed side agreements with New Zealand saying that they won't use ISDS or investors based in those countries won't use them. And one of those countries is Australia, which covers about 80% of our trade.
Right.
But that's quite misleading because, of course, multinational corporations don't need to use their Australian-based source.
Mm.
And Australia itself was sued by an Australian company that based itself, Philip Morris, in Singapore, had a base in Singapore and used that to sue Australia using an ISDS clause that, you know, that came out of a trade agreement that Australia and Singapore had.
Right, so, wow.
Yeah. Jeez. I mean, they actually lost, but they delayed warning labels on cigarettes in Australia for a number of years.
Oh, yes, I heard about that.
Yeah, so it can definitely happen, and it's definitely not the case that that these companies are based in a certain place and that, you know, you can kind of sign this away. You just have to get rid of ISDS altogether and trade agreements, as the EU has done. So,
sure. So just a final question. So the Green Party stated previously that the changes the bill made to the original TPPA don't go far enough. I guess you kind of covered that in the last response, but are there any other changes that the Green Party would have liked to have seen?
Well, at the core is the ISDS, but if you look closely enough at the agreement, the e-commerce chapter is quite frightening. I mean, it allows these foreign multinationals to keep information and data that they collect here offshore to bypass our privacy laws. And when you think about, you know, the data-driven economy that we have, the advantage that that gives them, and the danger of that to Kiwis, we've agreed not to regulate future unknown technologies.
Right.
Which is incredible to me, given, you know, we just have no idea what's going to happen with technology,
right.
And we've agreed to something like that. So it's very much all about upholding the status quo of power in the global economic system and deregulating it to benefit those who are already right now big.
Yeah.
So, you know, and I mean, that's already been proven to be so damaging with the last global economic collapse. Sure. We know that was because we agreed to deregulate these really big companies, and we've just signed on to a very similar model.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
That was the Green Party's Golriz Gehrman. We've just had a text in which is a bit of positivity on a Friday. It says, "We are all humans," or as I like to say when people ask me, "I'm an earthling. Love, Griselda X." Thank you very much, Griselda. Very much appreciate getting lovely texts like that in. Now over to Laura.
The controversy surrounding the National Party's alleged illegal donations has sparked much debate around ethics and donations. I reached out to political commentator Bryce Edwards to discuss the state of ethics. I started with asking him if there is a current state of distrust towards the donation system.
This is just a big question happening throughout the world at the moment. This interface between wealth and political parties, whereby, you know, wealthy individuals or business people give money to political parties to help them operate. And there's this growing concern, I think everywhere, that sometimes that those wealthy individuals might be seeking some sort of quid pro quo, some sort of payoff for what they are giving the political parties. Now, perhaps they are influencing the policies of those parties, or hoping to get some favour from them in the future. And so, yeah, I think there's a lot of scepticism about the democratic validity of having such big donations given from wealthy individuals to politicians. And so everywhere, you know, countries are setting up various regulations to try and control that. And sometimes it means that some donations are effectively banned. So, for example, in the US, businesses can't donate to political parties and politicians. Trade unions can't donate because people worry that those donations will come with strings attached. But there really isn't a consensus necessarily that donations are necessarily a bad thing, or that all donations are, you know, are seeking influence. But, you know, I think all countries are trying to come up with some sort of ways of regulating it to maybe make the situation less pernicious, making it a bit more robust. Sometimes that just means making the donation regime more open and transparent, so that the public can know who's making the donations, and then at least they can be aware of any untoward relationships between wealthy individuals and politics. So in New Zealand, yeah, we don't limit donations. You can give as much as you want to a political party, but it does have to be disclosed, and it does have to go on the public record if it's over a certain amount. But I don't think there's any real consensus amongst political scientists that donations are inherently a bad thing from private sources, but there is growing discomfort with it, and worrying that it's creating an unequal political system whereby wealth can control political parties.
Do you think that the controversy, particularly around donations, has created some level of distrust in our political systems on the whole, but specifically the National Party?
Yeah, there's no doubt that whenever there's a large scandal, you know, it publicises difficult questions about whether politicians are corrupt, or whether they are in some ways biased towards certain sources. And that's certainly happening now with this National Party scandal. People are worried that maybe the National Party is selling policy, or selling power for its party. People are starting to ask wider questions about other political parties as well, and whether maybe we need to clamp down on these donations, maybe we need to get the state to finance political parties, because it is the case that political parties do need money. They need to be able to raise funds in order to fund their operations, especially their electioneering. So there's big questions to be asked about, you know, what's the best way of funding political parties, and how to return confidence in the political system, because at the moment, Yes, I think worldwide, but particularly in lots of countries, there's a lot of discontent about politicians and about their connection to wealth, with this idea that maybe the politicians, once they get into government, are setting up an economy essentially that's rigged in favour of elites. And that is an increasingly common attitude amongst the public, and I think that is driving some big clampdowns on donations. So I think we can expect this debate to continue, and we can expect really discontent and distrust to keep rising amongst the public, because it does seem that the system isn't working at the moment.
And in regard to the system apparently not working at the minute, the Greens are calling for a donation reform. What do you think that would look like in terms of what the Greens are asking for?
Yeah, I mean, the Greens are talking about limiting how much wealth individuals can donate to political parties. They're talking about putting more regulations in place. And I think that's probably likely to find favour with a lot of New Zealanders, because the system, like I say, doesn't seem to be working. So, I think there'll certainly be a lot of interest in having more debate about this and having more clampdowns on those donations. So the Greens are also interested in the issue of state funding, providing more money to the political parties from taxpayers. I'm not sure that there will be as much of an appetite amongst the public for that side of things, because people already distrust the politicians, so they think, why should we actually pay more? Why would we actually want to subsidise them if they can't sort out their own finances and if they're already untrustworthy? So the Greens, I think, will probably end up more inclined to limit donations, to regulate them more, but I don't think they'll get much progress in terms of increasing the subsidies to political parties from taxpayers.
That was The Wire.
That was, of course, your Friday Wire for the 26th of October. Kia ora rawa atu. Thank you to everybody who joined us on the show today. We had Sam Smith, Amy Adams, Gorries Gerriman, Bryce Edwards, Corinda Taylor, and, of course, everyone who was kind enough to contribute to our piece on mental health. A big hand to them for offering their time to us. And thank you so very much to my producers, Laura. Lovely to have you helping me out in the studio today. And, of course, Claudia as well. Big thank you to you too. And to our amazing news director, Lillian Hanley. I've been Stuart Somerland. I hope I wasn't too much of a disaster. You'll be back with Laura next Friday. But don't tune out now, because Land of the Good Groove with Murray Kamik is up next. Keep it B.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95bfm.com/bcasts. That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95bfm.com/bcasts.